Gwendy says. According to Adesh, they've adapted quite well to zero-G conditions. She's looking at the boombox and the thing on top of it. Now she understands. How Adesh could have foreseen this situation is beyond her, but yes. She understands and knows what she must do. If she can.
Go in there, Senator. Get the box and give it to me.
She says very slowly and clearly. The fuck I will. I protected it as long as I could and as well as I could, and I'm not handing it over to you or anyone. Get it yourself.
Very well, but I think you'll come with me.
He grabs her by her shoulder, fingernails digging into her flesh. Dear. She pretends to struggle, backing up just far enough so her butt is against the work table with its microscope, monitors, and centrifuge. She puts a hand behind her, hoping she looks like she's trying to hold onto the table, actually grabbing for the gadget on top of the boombox. Please God, don't let him see and don't let me drop it, she thinks. Not that it will drop. It will float. She almost does lose her grip, but then the controller is in her hand and pressed against the small of her back. Winston snarls and points the green tube at her.
Enough! Get in there!
All right, I'll go. Just stop hurting me.
I'll do more than hurt you. Get in there! You're not running for the door, if that was in your mind.
If he looked down, he'd see she's hiding something. A flat, 8-inch rectangle that looks like a TV remote. It's pretty obvious. But Gareth Winston's attention is mostly focused on the thing he's come so far to obtain. His prize. His precious. They float into the large cage. Gwendy first. She manages to get the controller into the center pocket of her coverall while pretending to rub her hurt shoulder. Winston has slipped behind her, shoving her along.
Over there, against the wall.
He gives her a hard push. Gwendy floats backward. Please let this work. Oh God, please. He bends down and picks up the button box. A soft sigh escapes him. To Gwendy, it sounds almost sexual.
I feel it, he says. It's powerful, isn't it?
Very powerful, Gwendy agrees. The controller Adesh has left for her is just another button box, only with 4 buttons instead of 8. She doesn't know which of them opens Boris's cage, so she lays her index finger across all 4 and pushes them. Winston doesn't notice. He's running his own finger over the buttons. Light green and dark green for Asia and Africa, blue and violet for North and South America, orange for Europe, and yellow for Australia. Plus the 2 at the ends, red for wishes that turn dark no matter how well meant, and the black one, the cancer button. Meanwhile, the buttons on the controller have opened 4 cages. The doors rise soundlessly. Black ants float up from one, red ants from another, cockroaches from a third. From the 4th comes Boris, Pandanus Imperator. He rises, tail cocked.
What do they do, these buttons? Winston asks.
He has forgotten Gwendy completely in his absorption.
What happens when you press them?
Bad things, Gwendy says.
And the levers on the sides? What do they do?
Turn around, Gwendy says. And then, with great pleasure, look at me, you fat, psychotic piece of shit. His mouth drops open in surprise. His eyes widen in their pockets of puffy flesh. He turns. Gwendy suddenly realizes that Boris may not respond to her voice, so different from Adesh Patel's, but it's too late to worry about that now. She screams, Mar! She need not have worried. Boris lashes his poison-laden tail and speeds across the room, ignoring the flies in favor of a much bigger target. Winston cries out and raises a blocking hand, but in zero-G, he's far too slow. Gwendy is savagely delighted to see Boris's stinger bury itself dead center between Winston's eyes. He shrieks in pain and horror as he flails at the scorpion with both hands. There's a hole the size of a pencil point where the stinger went in. It's dribbling blood, and the flesh around it is already beginning to swell.
Get it off me! Jesus fucking Christ, get it off me!
Winston is batting at it with both hands. Boris disengages and avoids him easily, flicking his armored tail and zipping away. The button box floats in front of Winston, forgotten. His weapon, the green tube of death, Gwendy thinks, is also floating, but the rapid batting of Winston's hands, which continues even when Boris has cruised out of slapping range, sends it in Gwendy's direction, lazily turning end over end. She reaches for it. Winston also reaches for it, but the eddy set up by Winston's hands is in Gwendy's favor. She snatches the tube. Winston tries to grab her ponytail, and she sends it flying away from him with a shake of her head. She risks a glance down at the tube, wanting to make sure the ring end is pointed at herself. If it was the wrong way around and I blew my own guts to soup, I probably wouldn't even have time to appreciate the irony, she thinks, at the same time ducking in slow motion to avoid Winston's equally slow-mo roundhouse punch. Say goodbye to the smart-ass bitch, Winston. Gwendy points the tube and twists the ring in the base. There's no sound. There's no comic book death ray. Gwendy has a moment to think it was all a bluff, and then the front of Gareth Winston's white shirt blooms with red flowers. His eyes melt and roll down his cheeks in thick blue tears. Gray stuff begins to pour out of the empty sockets and from his nostrils. Gwendy realizes she's looking at his liquefied brains and begins to scream. Adesh has also left his phone, powered up, on the central work table and set his smartwatch to monitor it. The crew is sitting around the mess room table, shooting the shit and drinking post-breakfast coffee when his watch lights up. Adesh pushes the stem and they all hear Gwendy's screams. The screams have stopped by the time they get to the Spoke 5 etymology lab. Gwendy is backed up against a wall as far from the big enclosure as she can get, with her fisted hands pressed to her mouth and the button box in her lap. There's a babble of exclamations. Kathy, what in the hell? Adesh, shaking his fists in the air. You got him! He said you would! Jafari,
got who?
Dr. Glenn. Oh, my dear God in heaven. Doc has followed Gwendy's frozen gaze to the big cage, where the late Gareth Winston's clothes are floating in a pool of blood and decomposing organs. His throat has been blasted open. What remains of his face looks like a wrinkled and deflated rubber mask. It's crawling with red and black ants. Even at this moment, Adesh is the scientific observer rather than the horrified witness. The ants! They swam down to him! Adaptive behavior! Remarkable! Reggie Black leans over and loses his breakfast, which floats around him in wet chunks. Sam Drinkwater and Dave Graves do the same. Sam manages to catch most of his ejecta, but soon it's oozing through his cupped hands. Get out of here, Kathy snaps. Everyone out! We're sealing this room. If he's got some kind of Andromeda strain type disease... He doesn't, Gwendy says. His only disease was greed. And he died of it. Chapter 44. An hour later, the 9 remaining Eagle Heavy crew members are sitting in the conference room. At Gwendy's strong suggestion, which has been seconded from the down below by CIA Chief Charlotte Morgan, the Chinese have been locked off. They will still be able to access the outer rim, but they won't be able to enter any spokes but their own. Neither Charlotte nor Gwendy think the Chinese will be a problem, but Gwendy is a believer in the late Gareth Winston's mantra, always safe, never sorry. Of course, she thinks, he never expected Boris. The button box sits in the middle of the table beside an open, but highly protected, downlink to Charlotte's office in D.C. Kathy reaches for the box, and Gwendy has to restrain herself from pushing the commander's hand away. After one touch, Kathy pulls her hand back on her own and fast. Her eyes are wide. What is that thing? And without waiting for a reply, I want a complete report, Gwendy. You may be a United States senator, but up here I'm in charge, and I'm ordering you to tell me everything. She sweeps a hand around the table. All of us. Gwendy has no problem with that, and not just because they deserve to know. She will also need their cooperation to complete her final task. Charlotte is silent, but Gwendy knows she's listening. I will, but I need to know something first. She turns to Adesh. You set a trap for him, didn't you? Adesh nods. How did you know to do that? Did you see a man about your height wears a black derby hat? The idea that Ferris, sick or well, can be here is ridiculous. At the same time, it seems perfectly reasonable to Gwendy. In her experience, Ferris can appear anywhere and disappear just as quickly. It makes her think of an old song by heart, the one about the magic man. I saw no one, Adesh says, but I heard a voice in my head. You see, I'm sorry, this is embarrassing. No need to be embarrassed, Gwendy says and takes his hand. I believe you just played a very large part in saving the Earth and everyone on it. Sam Drinkwater makes a scoffing sound. Kathy, who has touched the button box and felt its power, makes no sound at all. Her attention is riveted on Gwendy and Adesh Bugman Patel. You said not to push the buttons, to not even touch them, and I kept that promise. You must believe me, Gwendy. Gwendy nods. Of course she does. But you said nothing about the tiny levers on the sides. Now Gwendy gets it. She smiles. Adesh unbuttons his pocket and brings out a Morgan silver dollar. He floats it across to her, heads and tails spinning lazily above the table. She doesn't have to look at the date to know it's 1891. The first lever I pulled produced that. I was always going to give it to you, Gwendy. I hope you believe that, too. Yes, she says, and floats it back with a flick of her finger. But I want you to keep it as a souvenir. Then you pulled the other one, yes, and got a chocolate. It was a thing of beauty, Adesh says, almost reverently. A little chocolate scorpion, just like Boris, Pandanus Imperator. He smiles and nods. Who could say anything is wrong with your memory? It was too perfect to eat, but you ate it anyway. Yes, something told me to. The desire was too strong to resist, and that is when I heard the voice. It sounded very old. Very tired and rather far away, but completely sure of itself. It said you would see and know what to do when the time came. Gwendy's eyes fill with tears. It was Ferris, all right. Her private deus ex machina. Old and tired, perhaps even dead, but still somewhere. And if anyone deserved a deus ex machina, it was she. And didn't her personal god from the machine have to be the man who'd gotten her into this in the first place?
Maybe we could go back to the beginning, Byrne Stapleton suggests. I, for one, would like to hear how one of the richest men on Earth ended up a puddle of goo with ants crawling on what remains of his face.
A very good idea, Kathy says. Let's hear it, Senator, from the beginning.
While I still can, Gwendy thinks. Because Adesh is mistaken, there's plenty wrong with her memory. It has begun to fog over again. She knows where she is. She knows these people are the crew she came up here with. But she can't remember any of their names except for Adesh Patel and Kathy London. Is it London? No matter. She leans across the table, pulls the lever on the right side of the button box, and pops a chocolate koala bear into her mouth. The fog rolls away. But of course it will be back, and soon the chocolates will disappear into deep space.
The beginning was when I was 12, she says. That's when I saw the button box for the first time and took possession of it.
She talks for 45 minutes, pausing for sips of water. No one interrupts, including Charlotte Morgan, who is hearing the whole story for the first time. Chapter 45. When she's finished, there's 30 seconds of silence while the eight of them digest what she's told them. Then Reggie Black clears his throat and says,
Let me be sure I understand you. You claim to be responsible for Jonestown, where 900 people died. This woman in Canada was responsible for the coronavirus, which killed 4 million and counting. Her name was Patricia Vecon. Gwendy says. Nothing wrong with her memory now. And it wasn't her fault.
In the end, she just couldn't resist the pull of the box, which is exactly what makes it so dangerous. Reggie makes a seesawing gesture with his hand. Maybe see, maybe no. And you also destroyed the Great Pyramid in an earthquake, killing 6 more. Charlotte speaks up for the first time. The speaker is so good, she could almost have been in the room with them. Not an earthquake, sir. No cause has been attributed. I didn't want anyone to die, Wendy says. She can't keep the tremble out of her voice. She is thinking about her old friend, Olive Kepnes, who died on the suicide stairs between Castle Rock and Castle View. Not ever. I thought the part of Guiana I was concentrating on was deserted. The pyramid was supposed to be locked down, totally empty, because of a fresh COVID outbreak. She leans forward, scanning them with her eyes. But those young people were there on a lark. This is what makes the button box so dangerous, don't you see? Even the red button is dangerous. It does what you're thinking of, but it does more. And my experience has been that the more is never good. I don't think the button box could be destroyed even in a nuclear furnace, and it works on the possessor's minds, which is why Ferris kept passing it on to new owners.
But always coming back to you, Jafari said.
Tell me, Reggie says, smiling, was the box also responsible for 9/11? Gwendy suddenly feels very tired. I don't know. Probably not. People don't need a button box to do horrible things. There's plenty of evil fuckery in the human spirit. Sam Drinkwater says flatly, I'm sorry, but I can't believe this. It's a fairy tale. From the speaker, Charlotte says, Is that Ops Drinkwater?
Yes, ma'am.
All right, Mr. Drinkwater, listen up. I have seen the interrogation with Detective Mitchell. Everything Gwendy has told you about the death of her husband is true. The cell phone footage is very disturbing, but our techs tell us none of it has been rigged or spiced up with special effects. As for the Great Pyramid, I was there when Gwendy named it and pushed that red button hours before it fell to pieces for reasons the science guys still can't figure out. I'm lifetime CIA. I don't believe anything unless I can prove it, and I believe this. I don't think the man who bribed the detective was human, or not precisely human. And I believe that box you're looking at is more dangerous than all the nuclear weapons on Earth put together. But no buts, Charlotte said briskly. Unless you think a hard-headed businessman like Gareth Winston died for a fantasy. She pauses. Which reminds me, we have to come up with a cover story to explain his death. Whatever it is that's going to shock the markets. Need to think about it carefully, Kathy says. Maybe. Gwendy, are you all right? Fine, Gwendy says. Little bit of a headache. Actually, an idea. Doc Glenn says gloomily, We'll have to shovel him up, you know. And that gadget he had is enough to convince me that something beyond our understanding is at work here. That gadget goes with him. Absolutely, Kathy says. Reggie Black, who, Gwendy believes, would have sided with doubting Thomas in the Bible, shakes his head. I'm willing to accept that it's all very strange. I'm not willing to accept that pushing that black button could destroy the whole world. Gwendy almost expects him to add, Let's try it and see, shall we? But he doesn't, which is good. If he even made a move toward the button box, Gwendy would have leaped across the table to stop him. It doesn't matter, Adesh says. Surely you all see that. They turn puzzled looks on him, Gwendy included. We send the box away in the device we call the pocket rocket. Whether it's a thing of supernatural evil or just a box that gives out chocolates and silver dollars, he shrugs and smiles. It's a very sweet smile. Either way, it's gone. The pocket rocket won't even be orbiting the Earth with the rest of the space junk we have been charting. The smile becomes dreamy. It will be off to the stars, never to come back. This logic is irrefutable. Kathy Lundgren turns to Gwendy. We'll do it tomorrow. You and me. My 9th spacewalk, your 1st. The one that's televised back home to your constituents will be your 2nd, but no one has to know that, do they? No, Gwendy says. Kathy nods. We'll watch the pocket rocket heading out toward the moon and Mars and the great beyond with its cargo on board. It sounds fine. What about Winston? For the time being, until we can decide how he died, Mr. Winston is okay. Just suffering a touch of zero-G space sickness and holed up in his cabin. Not feeling well enough to communicate with the down below. Or do you disagree?
No, Gwendy says. That's fine for now.
She's still sorry about what happened in Jonestown, even though she guesses much of it was the fault of the Reverend Jim Jones. She's sorry about the destruction of the Great Pyramid, and sorrier about the lives lost when it disassembled. But she's not sorry about Gareth Winston.
Which one of the levers dispenses the chocolates? Reggie Black asks.
That one, Gwendy points.
May I?
Gwendy doesn't want him to touch the box, but she does. Reggie pulls the lever. The slot opens and the shelf comes out. It's empty. Gwendy turns to Adesh. You try. The tiny shelf has gone back in. Adesh hooks his pinky around the lever and pulls gently. Out comes the shelf, this time bearing a small chocolate weasel. He looks at it, but gives it to Byrne. The biologist examines it, then puts it in his mouth, fingers ready to take it out if it's nasty. Instead, his eyes half close in an expression of ecstasy.
Oh my God, delicious!
Reggie Black looks put out. Why didn't it work for me?
Maybe, Gwendy says. The box doesn't like physicists.
Chapter 46. That night. Gwendy is walking the outer rim of the Many Flags space station. It makes its usual creaks and groans, haunted house sounds that the other man, the bad man, didn't like, but Gwendy doesn't mind them. She can't remember the bad man's name, although she's sure she could come up with it using Dr. Ambrose's chain of association. I'd just start with cigar, she thinks. The man walking beside her doesn't seem to mind the creaking sounds either. His face is serene and he's very beautiful, except his beauty is a mask. Sometimes his features waver like water in a pond blown by a strong breeze, and she can see his real face and head. He's some sort of weasel, like the chocolate treat the biologist got. Gwendy can't remember his name either. That's all right. She can remember the name of the man who isn't a man, though. It's Bobby. That's what the bad man called him. She thinks, cigar. She thinks, who smoked cigars? Winston Churchill did. And there it is. The bad man's name was Garen Winston, she says. Close enough, Bobby says. It doesn't matter. He's dead.
Melted,
Gwendy says, like the Wicked Witch in The Wizard of Ooz. Close enough, Bobby says again. What matters is this. There are other worlds than these.
I know, Gwendy says. Someone told me, but I don't remember who. Maybe Mr. Ferris.
That meddler, Bobby says. They walk. The space station creaks. They see no one because this is sleep time on MF. Except for the Chinese, holed up in their spoke, they are alone in the haunted house.
There are 12 worlds, Bobby says. 6 beams, 12 worlds, one at each end of each beam. And in the center is the tower. We call it Black 13.
Who is we?
The Tahin.
This means nothing to Gwendy.
The beams hold the worlds, and the tower powers the beams, Bobby says in a lecturely tone. Only one thing can destroy it. Now that the Crimson King is dead.
The button box, Gwendy says, but Bobby smiles and shakes his head. He makes a come on gesture with hands that sometimes blur into paws with sharp claws at the ends. The gesture says, you can do better. Gwendy starts to protest that she really can't. She's suffering from early onset Alzheimer's, probably caused by the box, but who knows for sure, then realizes she can.
The black button on the button box. The cancer button. Yes, Bobby says and pats her shoulder.
Gwendy shrinks away. She doesn't want him to touch her. It makes her feel the way the station's creaks and groans made the late Garen Winship feel.
You must not send the box away, Gwendy, What you need to do is push the black button. Destroy the tower. Destroy the beams. Destroy the worlds.
Rule Discordia?
That's right. Rule Discordia. End the universe. Bring the darkness.
Like in Jonestown? Only everyone and everything?
Yes.
But why?
Because chaos is the only answer. He looks down. Gwendy follows his gaze and sees she's holding the button box.
Push it, Gwendy. Push it now. You must, because...
Chapter 47. Gwendy wakes and is horrified to see she really is holding the button box, and her thumb is actually resting on the black button. She's standing in front of the open safe in her closet, the spare pressure suit crumpled at her feet.
Chaos is the only answer, she whispers. Existence is a dead equation.
The urge to push the button, if only to end her own misery and confusion, is strong. She would like Ferris to step in as he did for Adesh and rescue her, but there is no voice in her head and no sense of him. She groans, and somehow that sound breaks the spell. She puts the button box back in the safe, starts to swing the door shut, then decides she's not done with it quite yet. She doesn't want to touch it for fear that horrible compulsion might come back, but she has to. She pulls one of the levers and a chocolate comes out. She pops it into her mouth and the world instantly clarifies. She pulls the lever again, afraid the little platform will slide out empty this time, but another chocolate appears. It's a dachshund that looks exactly like her father's longtime companion, Pippa. She goes to put it in her pocket, it's for later, but then realizes she has no pockets. She's in her sleep shorts and a University of Maine tee. But that's not all. She's got a sneaker on one foot, a sock on the other, and she's wearing a pair of the insulated work gloves each member of the crew has been issued. There's probably a reason for the gloves. On Eagle Heavy and the MF station, there's a reason for every bit of clothing and equipment, but she can't remember what it is. Sudden temperature drop, maybe? Her deteriorating condition keeps manifesting itself in different ways, and she sees now that she has written left and right on the gloves. But how long before I forget what those words mean? How long before I can't read at all? These thoughts make her feel like crying, but she can't waste any time on tears. She doesn't know how long the chocolate will keep her in the clear, and the spare is for tomorrow, right before she and Kathy Lundgren suit up for their spacewalk at 0800 hours. Kathy. With her mind right, she realizes what she should have known much earlier. Gwendy goes to her phone, selects Kathy's name from the MF directory, and makes the call. As the officer in charge of the mission, first ops, Kathy always keeps her phone on. She'll hear the beep and respond. She must respond, because what Gwendy has realized is that she can't do this on her own. If she tries, Kathy will stop her. Unless, that is, she has reasons not to. The phone only rings once, and when Kathy answers, her voice is clear and crisp. Maybe not sleeping at all, no matter how late the hour. Gwendy, is there a problem?
A solution, I think. I need to talk to you.
All right. No hesitation. Come to my quarters. Chapter 48. Kathy Lundgren's quarters are smaller and more austere than Gwendy's, but she has cocoa packets squirreled away and makes them each a cup. The sweetness reminds Gwendy of her early childhood, cocoa with her dad on early summer mornings with a mist still on the lawn. After one sip, she puts her cup on the little table beside Kathy's narrow bed, no sitting room here, and tells Eagle Heavy's first ops what she's been trying to hide.
You were right. Doc was right. Even Winston knew.
I do have early onset Alzheimer's, and it's now progressing very rapidly.
But the test we gave you proved.
It proved nothing. I aced it because of the chocolates, but the effects don't last. A few minutes ago, I woke up wearing gloves and one sneaker. The sneaker wasn't tied because I can't remember how to tie my shoes anymore.
Kathy looks at her in silent horror,
which Gwendy understands, and sympathy, which she hates. For a while, I still could because I found a jingle on the net that I learned when I was in primary school. Something about bunny ears. As anxious and afraid as she is, that makes Gwendy laugh. You too, huh? Only now I can't remember the jingle. Unless I've eaten a chocolate, that is. You ate one before coming here, I assume. Gwendy nods. But they're dangerous, like everything to do with the button box. And the box is getting stronger while I get weaker. When I woke up, just before I called you, I had it in my hands, and I was getting ready to push the black button. My thumb was actually on it. Thank God you're getting rid of it. We're getting rid of it. And that's not all. Gwendy takes a deep breath. I want to go with it. Kathy has been bringing her cup to her mouth. Now she sets it down hard. Are you crazy? Well, yes, that's sort of what Alzheimer's is, Kath. But at this moment, I've never been saner or more present. She leans forward, pinning Kathy's eyes with her own. When the button box goes, the chocolates go. If I'm still here, my decline will be very rapid. By the time we get back to Earth, I might not even know my own name. Kathy opens her mouth to protest, but Gwendy overrides her. Even if I do, the time will come when I don't. I'll be wearing diapers, sitting in my own piss and shit until someone comes to change me, staring out the window of some expensive rest home in D.C. or Virginia, not knowing what I'm staring at, having just enough brain power left to know that I'm lost and can never find my way back to myself. Rule Discordia, she thinks. She's crying now, but her voice remains steady. I could tell you that I'd find a discreet way of committing suicide when we get back to the down below, but I don't think I could be discreet, and I don't think I'd know how to do it. I might forget how to do it. And Kathy, I'm only 64 and physically healthy. I could go on like that for 10 years before a pneumonia or a mutated form of COVID took me. Maybe 15 or 20. Gwendy, I understand, but please don't condemn me to that, Kathy. Listen, when I was a little girl, my folks bought me a telescope. I spent hours looking at the planets and stars through it, often with my father, but once with my mom. We looked at Scorpius and talked about God. I want to go with the box, Kathy. I want to point the pocket rocket towards Scorpius and know that someday, millions of years from now, I might actually get there. She smiles. If there's life after death, my mother believed that. I might be there in spirit to greet my perfectly preserved body. I do understand, Kathy says. And I would if I could. But you have to think of me a little bit, okay? Think about what would happen to me afterward. Losing my commission and my job, which I love, wouldn't be all. I'd probably go to jail. No, Gwendy says. Not if everyone else goes along with what I have in mind. Sam, Jaff, Reggie, Adesh, Byrne, Dave, and Doc. And they will, because it will stop an investigation that would shut down TetCorp's plans for space exploration and tourist travel for a year. Maybe two or even five. Tet's in a race with SpaceX and Blue Origin now. That guy Branson, too. Do you think our guys want to get years behind? Kathy is frowning. I don't know what you're... She stops. Winston. You're talking about Winston. Yes, because any story you cobble together to explain his death will be suspicious. Explosive decompression. Even if Dave Graves could rig the onboard computers to show there had been such a decompression, and I have my doubts. A story like that would shut down the MF, Gwendy says. All those tourist plans, Tet's and SpaceX's, would be frozen. That's in addition to the investigation into you and the whole crew. Gwendy pauses, then plays her trump card. She has saved it for last, as she always did in contentious committee meetings. Plus there's me. I'd be questioned, and with my ability to think rapidly bleeding away, who knows what I might say. Jesus Christ, Kathy mutters, and runs her hands through her short hair. But there's a solution. This is also the way she played it in committee hearings, learned from Patsy Follett. First hit him with the sledgehammer, Patsy used to say, then offer them the painkillers. What solution? Kathy is looking at her mistrustfully.
Our spacewalk tomorrow is unauthorized, right? No one knows about it but Charlotte Morgan and our Eagle Heavy crewmates. Right? Gwendy sips her cocoa. So good, with its memories of Castle Rock on summer mornings with her father. She puts it down and leans forward, arms on her thighs, hands clasped between her knees. We're not going to take that spacewalk.
We're not?
No. Gareth and I will take it, unbeknownst to you or anyone else in the crew. We decided to do it on our own, and because we're inexperienced, we didn't use tethers or a buddy cable. Something went wrong and we just floated away into the void. Why would you do a crazy thing like that? Why did the Mary Celeste show up deserted but seaworthy and under full sail? What happened to the crew of the Carol A. Deering? There's nothing wrong with Gwendy's recall for the time being. She hasn't thought about the Carol Deering since a book report she did in the 8th grade. No one knows. And if you 8 can keep a secret, no one will ever know why Winston and I decided to go for a little stroll in space. Kathy says. To be cold-blooded about it. I want you to be. It would solve 2 problems. We wouldn't have to explain the gooey death of Gareth Winston, and we wouldn't have to worry about you saying certain things as your, condition worsens. Charlotte Morgan will help you, Gwendy says. She'll make sure she's in charge of debriefing the crew, and she'll apply a coat of whitewash for obvious reasons. Also, she'll want to get her hands on that disintegrator thingy. I suppose she would. I need to think about this. Gwendy takes her hands and squeezes them lightly. No, she says. You don't. Chapter 49. Back in her quarters, Gwendy sits down at her desk, opens the record app on her phone, and begins talking immediately. There's no time to waste. The chocolate may start wearing off any time, but it doesn't take long to say what she has to say. When she's finished, she scribbles a quick note. She rubber bands it to her phone and puts the phone in a manila envelope. She begins to close it, then thinks again and adds something else. She seals it and writes Adesh on the front in big capital letters. Then she goes back to bed. She falls asleep with 2 hopes. No more dreams of the monster that calls itself Bobby. And that when she wakes up, her mind will wake up with her. Chapter 50. The crew meeting in the conference room takes place at 0600. Kathy lays the situation out with a crisp conciseness Gwendy couldn't possibly have matched now that the effects of her late-night chocolate treat are almost gone. They are bright men, and they understand. They also understand the solution Gwendy has proposed will save a great deal of trouble, expense, and possible Senate hearings where they will be mercilessly grilled on nationwide TV. There is only 1 substantive question, and it comes from Reggie Black. What happens to Winston? Or what remains of him?
Vaporized with the rest of the trash before we leave the station, Sam Drinkwater says, and makes a sucking sound. Poof! Gone. No one has anything to say to that.
When the meeting ends, the crew stands in a kind of receiving line. Each of them hugs Gwendy. Adesh is last. I'm sorry, he says as he hugs her. You've been so brave. You don't deserve this, and I am so, so sorry. She hugs him back. I have an envelope for you. My phone is inside, with a message for my father. Would you take it to him? It will be an honor. He wipes his eyes, but his tears, emblems of his grief and regard, float in front of his face.
And I'm going where no woman has gone before, so don't cry for me, Margentina.
She frowns. Is that right? Margentina?
Absolutely, Adesh says. Absolutely right. Chapter 51. 0730. There are airlocks on the MF, one in the outer rim beyond each of the even-numbered spokes, but Gwendy and Kathy will egress from Eagle Heavy, where the air tastes stale and the 3 crew station levels feel abandoned.
Before suiting up, Gwendy pops the chocolate she saved into her mouth.
"Don't suppose you have another one of those, do you?" Kathy asks.
Gwendy considers, shrugs, and then loosens the drawstring top of the aluminum quilted bag on the bench beside her. She brings out the button box. It feels dull now, powerless, as if resigned to its fate. But Gwendy doesn't trust that. She pulls the lever that delivers the chocolates. The cunning little platform slides out, but there's nothing on it.
"Sorry, Kath. The button box giveth, and sometimes it don't giveth."
"Roger that.
Would have liked to try one, though."
"Are you good, Gwendy?" Gwendy nods. She's very good. With the chocolate on board, she's clear as a bell. The woman who had to print right and left on her gloves is gone, but she'll be back. Or maybe not.
"What's funny?" Kathy asks.
"You're smiling."
"Nothing."
But because something more seems required, she adds, "Just excited about my first spacewalk." Kathy makes no reply, but Gwendy can read her thought. "First and last. Are you sure the computers in mission control won't register us opening the airlock down here?"
"Positive. These computers are all off until the return, to conserve power."
They float their way into the airlock, helmets under their arms, and sit on the two benches. The space is tight.
All spaces are tight on heavy.
And their knees touch. Gwendy starts to put her helmet on, but Kathy shakes her head.
"Not yet. 60 inhales and exhales first. Pre-breathing, remember?"
Gwendy nods. "To purge the nitrogen."
"Right."
"Gwendy, are you sure?"
"Yes."
She answers with no hesitation. Everything is in place. The story they will tell later, set and agreed to by all hands. Gwendy and Winston weren't at breakfast, but no one thought that was unusual because they are passengers, supercargo, and have the luxury of sleeping in. No one will start to worry until at least 1000 hours, and by then, Kathy will be back on board the MF. There will be a search. It will be at least 1400 before Sam Drinkwater calls the down below to tell them the VIPs are missing and may have drifted away while attempting a spacewalk. Terrible accident. God knows why they would have done something so foolish, blah, blah, blah. Gwendy gets a little woozy from the fast respiration. Kathy tells her that's normal and will pass by the time they egress Eagle Heavy. After 2 minutes of breathing, Kathy tells Gwendy it's time to put on her bucket.
"And remember, helmet-to-helmet comm only. No one hears but just us girls.
Let me hear your Roger."
"Roger that,"
Gwendy says and dons her bucket. Kathy moves to help her secure it, but Gwendy waves her off, does it herself, and looks for the green light on the little control panel at mouth level. When she sees it, she dons her gloves, secures them, and waits for a second green light. She makes a thumb and finger circle to Kathy, who returns the gesture. Kathy closes the door to Eagle Heavy, and the two of them sit waiting for the airlock to depressurize.
"Reading me, Gwendy?"
"Loud and clear."
"Set your suit temp to maximum hot, then adjust it down."
"How long will the heat last?"
"In theory, as long as your breathable air, just shy of 6 hours. The heat may actually last longer, but..."
Her shrug says the rest.
"But you won't feel it."
There's a belt around Gwendy's waist, with two ordinary high-altitude carabiners attached. She knots the drawstring bag with the button box around one of them. Kathy attaches the buddy cable to the other. They are now tethered together like scuba divers, the instructor and the pupil.
"Ready to EVA?" Kathy asks.
Gwendy makes another thumb and forefinger circle. She thinks,
"Oh yes, very ready. Been waiting for this ever since I first looked through my telescope over 50 years ago. I just didn't know it."
"Don't wait too long to lower your outer visor. Night pass ends in just about 7 minutes.
"Roger."
Kathy turns the red lever in the center of the airlock's outer door, then pulls it. 0748. The airlock opens on the stars. Chapter 52. They float into space, tethered. Gwendy can hear her own breathing and, through the helmet-to-helmet comm, Kathy's. Beside them is Eagle Heavy, and she can see where someone from the ground crew has printed "Good luck, you guys" on the fuselage in Sharpie. Below them is Earth, blue and cloud-streaked, with a golden nimbus growing on one gorgeous shoulder. Here comes the sun, Gwendy thinks. Kathy leads them slowly downward, using indented handholds on Heavy's flank. Near the bottom, these handholds are smudged from the blast of the last rocket bursts as Kathy lined them up for docking. On the way down, they pass hatches labeled A through E. The last one, hatch F, is just above the rocket boosters. It's the only one with a keypad. The others can be opened with a simple socket wrench. Kathy has to duck under a solar panel to get at it. She raises the little plexi shield over the pad and punches the combination Gwendy has given her. It's the same one that opened the classified case. The thing Kathy floats out makes Gwendy smile. The pocket rocket is 4 feet long, or maybe a bit less. To Gwendy, it looks almost exactly like the craft that brought Kal-El, a.k.a. Superbaby, to Earth. Her father gave away most of his old comic books, or lost them. But Gwendy found a box of old Supermans in the attic and read them eagerly, again and again. Kathy floats the pocket rocket up between them. There's a hatch on top, held by simple latches that look about as high-tech as the ones on the Scooby-Doo lunchbox Gwendy carried to elementary school. Kathy flips them, reaches inside, and brings out a controller that looks like the one Gwendy used to release Boris in Adesh's lab. Except this one is smaller, and there are only two buttons. Another button box, Gwendy thinks. Those damn things are my destiny. Kathy points to the drawstring bag floating around Gwendy's waist, then points at the open hatch on top of the pocket rocket. Her meaning is clear. Put it inside. But all at once, Gwendy doesn't want to. Mine. It's mine. This one really is my destiny. Kathy raises her outer visor, and Gwendy can see she's frightened. Even though Kathy has never seen the button box in action, she's scared to death. That expression is enough for Gwendy to free the bag from the carabiner holding it. She can feel the corners of the button box inside. No, the thing called Bobby whispers in her head. Don't do this. The tower must not stand. Rule Discordia. Then she thinks of Richard Ferris's weary face when he said, "How I loathe it." Rule my ass, she says. She doesn't just place the button box in the pocket rocket's belly. She rams it in. Say again? Kathy asks. I wasn't talking to you, Gwendy says, and flips the latches closed. Meanwhile, the controller is floating away. Gwendy reaches for it, but at that moment, the sun comes over the curve of the Earth's horizon, blinding her. She forgot something after all, to lower her outer visor. She slams it down, panicked. If the controller is lost... But Kathy has snatched it just before it can drift out of reach. She hands it to Gwendy. Last chance, hon. You don't have to go with it. No, Gwendy agrees. But I'm going to. I choose to. Give me a hug, Kathy. Probably ridiculous, but I need it. The two of them hug clumsily in their bulky suits, while the newly risen sun turns their visors into curved oblongs of amber fire. Then Kathy lets go, unclips the buddy cable from her waist, and reattaches her end to a D-ring on the pocket rocket's rounded nose. Gwendy supposes that handy ring allowed some crane operator to lift the pocket rocket up to the F-hatch. Kathy says, "The engine is nuclear-powered." "I know," Kathy ignores her. "And no bigger than a cigarette pack. Marvel of technology. Push the top button to power it up. You'll start moving immediately, but very slowly, like a car in low gear. You understand?" "Yes." "Tap the lower button, and you'll speed up. Each time you tap it, you'll speed up more. Following me?" "Yes." "And she is. But she's looking at the stars. Oh, they are gorgeous, and how can anyone look at that spill of light and believe life is anything but a hall of mysteries?" "There's no guidance system, no joystick. Once you start, you just go, and you can't come back." "You can't come back, Gwendy. Do you understand?" Yes. All right, then. Kathy reaches behind herself and grasps one of the handholds. Soon she will follow them back up, kicking her feet like a diver seeking the surface. Back to warmth and light and the companionship of her crewmates. If you meet any ETs, tell them Kathy Lundgren says hello. Roger that, Gwendy says and gives a salute. 6 hours, she thinks. I have 6 hours to live. God bless you, Gwendy. And you. There's nothing left to say. So Gwendy pushes the top button on her last button box. A dull red ring glows in the pocket rocket's base, a paltry light that's no match for the sun's splendor. Is it giving off harmful radiation? Possibly, but does it matter? The slack runs out of the buddy cable. It pulls taut, and then Gwendy is moving away from Eagle Heavy and beneath the outer ring of the Many Flags station. She knows no one is watching, but she gives it a wave anyway. Then it's behind her. She taps the speed control button twice, lightly, and begins to move faster, flying horizontally behind the pocket rocket with her legs splayed. It's a little like surfing, but it's really like nothing she has ever experienced. Like no one has ever experienced, she thinks, and laughs. Gwendy? Kathy's voice is growing faint. Soon it will be gone. Already the MF is receding, glowing in the sunlight like a jewel in the navel of the earth. Are you okay? Brilliant, Gwendy says. And she is. She is. Chapter 53. 5 hours later. Now there's just the red ring of the pocket rocket's nuclear drive ahead of her as it tugs her steadily onward into the black. It reminds Gwendy of the dashboard cigarette lighter in her father's old Chevrolet. There's a temperature gauge among the dozen or so digital readouts inside her helmet, and it registers the outside temperature as minus 435 Fahrenheit, but her suit is a toasty warm 72 degrees. Her remaining oxygen is down to 17%. It won't be long now. Of course, there's no speed gauge among the readouts, so Gwendy has no idea how fast she's going. There's little or no sensation of movement at all. When she peers over her shoulder, not easy in the suit, but possible, Earth looks exactly the same, big, blue, and beautiful, but the MF station is lost to view. Gwendy looks ahead again at the Milky Way. She wishes the brightest of them was Scorpius, but she's pretty sure it's Sirius, also known as the Dog Star, because it's part of the Canis Major constellation. That makes her think of her father's sausage dog, Pippin. Only that's not right, is it? Pippa, she whispers. Pippa, the dachshund. She's losing it again. The fog is closing in. Gwendy fixes her eyes on Sirius, which is roughly at 10 o'clock in her field of vision. Second star on the right and straight on till morning, she thinks. What's that from? Hansel and Gretel, isn't it? But that's not right. She trawls her dimming mind for the correct story or fairy tale and finally comes up with it. Peter Pan. 15% oxygen now, and it will be a race between the end of her breathable air and the end of her ability to think. Only she doesn't want to go out that way, not knowing where she is. Or if she does know that, outer space is kind of hard to mistake for the bus station in Castle Rock, after all, why she's out here. She'd like to go out knowing all this happened for a reason. That in the end, she completed the task set before her. That she saved the world. All the worlds, she whispers, because there are more worlds than ours. She doesn't have to go out puzzled and confused, nor does she have to go out cold and shivering if her heat quits before her breathable air. She seems to remember Carol, if that's her name, saying the heat would last longer, but her suit's temp has begun to drop a degree at a time. She has another option. She has only one disappointment. In 1984, 10 years after Richard Ferris gave her the button box, he came to take it back. He sat in her small kitchen with her,
They had coffee cake and milk, like old friends, which they sort of were, and Mr. Ferris had told her future. He said she was going to be accepted at the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and she was. He told her she was going to win an award. Wear your prettiest dress when you pick it up. And she did. Not the Nobel, but the Los Angeles Times Book Award was not to be sneezed at. He told her she had many things to tell the world, and that the world would listen. And that had been true prophecy. But the mysterious derby-wearing Mr. Ferris had certainly never told her she would end a mostly warm and loving life in the deep cold of outer space. He'd told her she'd live a long life. 64 wasn't young, but she didn't consider it old either, although in 1984 she probably would have considered it ancient. He told her she would die surrounded by friends, not alone in the universe and being tugged ever deeper into the void behind a tiny rocket that would continue running on power for 70 years or more, and then continue in an endless inertial glide.
You will die in a pretty nightgown with blue flowers on the hem, Ferris told her. There will be sun shining in your window, and before you pass, you will look out and see a squadron of birds flying south. A final image of the world's beauty. There will be a little pain. Not much. No friends here. The last ones she made were far behind her. A spacesuit instead of a pretty nightgown. And certainly no birds.
Even the sun was gone for the time being, temporarily eclipsed by the earth. And was she crying? Damn it, she was. The tears didn't even float because she was under constant acceleration. But the tears were fogging up her visor. The stars she'd been watching, Rigel? Deneb? Was blurring.
Mr. Ferris, you lied, she said. Maybe you didn't see the truth. Or maybe you did and didn't want me to have to live with it. No lie, Gwendy.
His voice, as clear as it had been as they sat in her kitchen 42 years ago, eating coffee cake and drinking milk.
You know what to do. And there's still enough of that last chocolate in your brain to give you time to do it.
Gwendy uses the valve on the left side of her helmet to begin bleeding the remaining air from her suit. It disappears behind her in a frozen cloud. Her visor clears and she can see that star again. Not Rigel, not Scorpius, but Sirius. Second star on the right. A kind of rapture steals into her as she breathes the last of her thinning air. I am in bed now, and I am old, much older than 64. Yet the people who surround me are young and beautiful. Even Patsy Follett is young again. Bridget Desjardins is here. Sheila Brigham. Norris Ridgwick. Olive Kepnes is here. And, Mom, you hardly look 20 years old.
I was, you know, Alicia Peterson says, laughing. Hard as that might be for you to believe.
I love you, hon.
And now she sees Ryan? Is it really you?
He takes her hand.
It is.
You're back.
I never left.
He leans down to kiss her.
Someone wants to say goodbye.
He stands aside to let Mr. Ferris come forward. His sickness is gone. He looks like the man Gwendy first saw sitting on a bench near the Castleview playground when she was 12. He's holding his hat in his hand.
Gwendy, he says, and touches her cheek.
Well done, Gwendy.
Very well done.
She's not in space. Not anymore. She's an old woman lying in her childhood bed. She's wearing a pretty nightgown with blue flowers on the hem. She has done her duty, and now she can rest. She can let go.
Look out the window, Mr. Ferris says, and points.
She looks out. She sees a squadron of birds. Then they are gone, and she sees a single shining star. It's Scorpius, and heaven lies beyond it. All of heaven.
Second star to the right, Gwendy says with her final breath.
And straight on till... Her eyes close. The pocket rocket with the button box in its belly drives onward into the cosmos, as it will for the next 10,000 years, towing its space-suited figure behind.
straight on till morning. Epilogue. One night, sometime after all these things, Gwendy Peterson's father sits at his window in the nursing home where he lives, frailer, more unsteady, but, as he often says, not too bad for an old fella. He's looking out at the stars and thinking that somewhere out there in their endless multitude, his daughter continues her pilgrimage. Her phone, brought to him by a nice Indian man named Adesh Patel, is in his lap. Patsy Follett, Gwendy's mentor, might not have had as many witty sayings as Oscar Wilde, but she'd had her share. One of them was, "A scandal lasts 6 months. A scandal that's also a mystery lasts 6 years. It's only been 3 years since Senator Peterson and the billionaire businessman disappeared into space, but the march of current events has driven it from the forefront of people's minds. Not from Mr. Peterson's, however. It's hell to outlive your only child, and the fierceness of his loss is mitigated by only two things: the knowledge that he can't have much longer himself, and he has her voice to comfort him. Her last recorded message. The world doesn't need to know she died a hero. It's enough for Mr. Peterson that he knows." A week after Adesh Patel's surprise appearance, Gwendy's dad had another visitor. A woman this time. The day manager of the Castleview nursing home, a haughty little fellow with a pencil-thin mustache, who insisted the residents address him as Mr. Winchester, sauntered into the sunroom where Alan was playing hearts with Ralph Mirarchi, Mick Meredith, and Homer Bellico. He introduced the tall blonde lady towering over his shoulder as Deputy Director Charlotte Morgan of the Central Intelligence Agency. He quickly shooed the other men out of the room, and after offering their guest a ridiculous half-bow, left them alone. The woman flashed Mr. Peterson a bemused look, a look that said, "I'm sorry you're stuck here with such a first-class tool," and sat down across from him. "Please call me Charlotte, Mr. Peterson. I'm an old and dear friend of your daughter's."
"In that case, you better call me Alan."
He rubbed the gray whiskers on his chin, wishing he'd shaved this morning. This lady is a looker.
"And I didn't figure you came all this way to talk about spies and foreign policy."
"No, sir, not today." She smiled and reached over to touch his hand. "But I do have something important to tell you, something highly confidential that you must promise to never repeat to anyone else." He raised his right hand in the air.
"So help me God."
"That's good enough for me."
She took a quick glance over her shoulder to make sure they were still alone in the sunroom. Mr. Peterson, suddenly feeling as if he were playing a bit role in a James Bond spy film, did the same. When he looked back at his daughter's old friend, he was surprised to see that there were tears shimmering in her eyes.
"I could lose my job and end up in Leavenworth for what I'm about to tell you, but I don't care. I loved Gwendy. She was family."
"Whatever it is, it'll go to my grave with me."
And probably sooner than later, he thought.
"Your daughter didn't sneak out for an illicit spacewalk. Anyone who truly knew her knows that part of the story is bullshit." She took a deep breath, the kind that says, "You are past the point of no return now," and continued. "Gareth Winston was a bad man, Mr. Peterson, and he'd gotten a very bad idea into his head, a dangerous one. Gwendy found out and put a stop to it before it was too late. She sacrificed her life so that others, millions of others, could live. I suppose that sounds awfully dramatic, but I swear to you it's true."
Alan nodded.
"That sounds like our Gwendy."
"I can't even begin to imagine the courage it took for her to do what she did. But she completed the task willingly, and I believe with only one regret, that she would never return home to see you again. She talked about you and your wife all the time. She adored you, Mr. Peterson."
"The feeling was mutual," he said in a choked and tired voice.
With the memory of her visit fading, he stares down at the iPhone resting in his lap. And as he has done on so many other occasions, he presses the play button and closes his eyes.
"Hi, Dad. I don't have much time, but I wanted to tell you I'm sorry.
Please don't be too sad, and whatever you do, don't waste a precious minute on being angry or bitter.
And no matter what you hear or see on the news, just remember this. I had a job to do, an important one, and I did it the best way I knew how. A long time ago, back when I was a little girl in pigtails running around the playground at Castleview Park, you told me something I've never forgotten. When faced with the choice of doing the right thing or nothing at all, you do what's right. Every single time. I am so proud to be your daughter. There wasn't a better father anywhere in the world. Please smile when you think of me. Please remember the good times. How lucky we were. You and me and Mom. The Three Musketeers, she used to call us. Okay, I better get going. You know how I hate to be late. Goodbye for now, Pa. I love you with all of my heart, and I will see you again. Mom and I both will. I left you a surprise inside the envelope. It's yours now. Take good care of it. It's very special. You might even say it's magic, he whispers in the silence of his dark room. Alan Peterson pulls out the small white feather from the pocket of his robe. It's never far from him these days. He stares at it, remembering, and then places the feather upon the windowsill beside him. It's immediately bathed in moonlight. His eyes are once again drawn to the night sky outside the window. There are so many stars tonight. Even with the oak tree blocking much of his view, he can spot the Milky Way and Taurus the Bull. High above its tallest branches, Orion the Hunter peers down at him. The words suddenly slip into his head unbidden. Mr. Peterson has no idea where they came from or what they mean, but he likes the sound of them so much he says them out loud. There are other worlds than these. Sitting there, staring up at the infinite darkness, he thinks they are easy words to believe.
Gwendy's Final Task, a novel, was written by Stephen King and Richard Chismar, and read by Marin Ireland. It was recorded by Noriko Okabe at Simon & Schuster and James Yost at Reservoir Studios in New York. Editing, mix, and post-production by Like 2,000 Pounds. The associate producer was Joy Asukwo. Gwendy's Final Task was produced and directed by Tiffany Ferrari. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Gwendy's Final Task, a novel, is available in print from Gallery Books. Also from Gwendy's Button Box Trilogy, Gwendy's Button Box, a novella, written by Stephen King and Richard Chismar, read by Maggie Siff. And Gwendy's Magic Feather, a novel, written by Richard Chismar with a foreword by Stephen King, and read by Maggie Siff.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this